Chapter 34. One side of the carriage, while Madame Peitel descended from the other, and he fired a second pistol at his domestic, Louis Ray, whom he had just recognized. Redoubling his pace, he came up with Ray, and struck him, from behind, a blow with the hammer. Ray turned at this, and raised up his arm, to strike his master with the pistol which he had just discharged at him. But Peitel, more quick than he, gave the domestic a blow with the hammer, which felled him to the ground. He fell his face forwards, and then Peitel, bestriding the body, dispatched him, although the brigand asked for mercy. He now began to think of his wife and ran back, calling out her name repeatedly, and seeking for her, in vain, on both sides of the road. Arrived at the bridge of Andert, he recognized his wife, stretched in a field, covered with water, which he ordered the Furons. This horrible discovery had, so much the more astonished him, because he had no idea, until now, that his wife had been wounded. He endeavored to draw her from the water, and it was only after considerable exertions, that he was enabled to do so, and to place her, with her face towards the ground, on the side of the road. Supposing that, here, she would be sheltered from any farther danger, and believing, as yet, that she was only wounded, he determined to ask for help at a lone house, situated on the road towards Rossillon, and at this instant he perceived, without at all being able to explain how, that his horse had followed him back to the spot, having turned back of its own accord, from the road to Belly. The house at which he knocked was inhabited by two men, of the name of Thanet, father and son, who opened the door to him, and whom he entreated to come to his aid, saying that his wife had just been assassinated by his servant. The elder Thanet approached to, and examined the body, and told Peitel that it was quite dead. He and his son took up the corpse, and placed it in the bottom of the carriage, which they all mounted themselves, and pursued their route to Belly. In order to do so, they had to pass by Ray's body, on the road, which Peitel wished to crush under the wheels of his carriage. It was to rob him of 7,500 francs, said Peitel, that the attack had been made. Our friend, the procureur's substitute, has dropped, here, the eloquent and pathetic style altogether, and only gives the unlucky prisoner's narrative in the baldest and most unimaginative style. How is a jury to listen to such a fellow? They ought to condemn him, if but for making such an uninteresting statement. Why not have helped poor Peitel with some of those rhetorical graces which have been so plentifully bestowed in the opening part of the act of accusation? He might have said, Monsieur Peitel is an eminent notary at Belly. He is a man distinguished for his literary and scientific acquirements. He has lived long in the best society of the capital. He had been but a few months married to that young and unfortunate lady, whose loss has plunged her bereaved husband into despair, almost into madness. Some early differences had marked, it is true, the commencement of their union, but these, which, as can be proved by evidence, were almost all the unhappy lady's fault, had happily ceased, to give place to sentiments far more delightful and tender. Gentlemen, Madame Peitel bore in her bosom a sweet pledge of future concord between herself and her husband. In 3 brief months she was to become a mother. In the exercise of his honorable profession, in which, to succeed, a man must not only have high talents, but undoubted probity, and, gentlemen, Monsieur Peitel did succeed, did inspire respect and confidence, as you, his neighbors, well know. In the exercise, I say, of his high calling, Monsieur Peitel, towards the end of October last, had occasion to make a journey in the neighborhood, and visit some of his many clients. He traveled in his own carriage, his young wife beside him. Does this look like want of affection, gentlemen, or is it not a mark of love and paternal care on his part towards the being with whom his lot in life was linked, the mother of his coming child, the young girl, who had everything to gain from the union with a man of his attainments of intellect, his kind temper, his great experience, and his high position. In this manner they traveled, side by side, lovingly together. Monsieur Pétel was not a lawyer merely, but a man of letters and varied learning. Of the noble and sublime science of geology he was, especially, an ardent devotee. Suppose, here, a short panegyric upon geology. Allude to the creation of this mighty world, and then, naturally, to the Creator. Fancy the conversations which Pétel, a religious man, asterisk might have with his young wife upon the subject.
Asterisk he always went to Mass, it is in the evidence. Monsieur Pétel had lately taken into his service a man named Louis Ray. Ray was a foundling, and had passed many years in the regiment, a school, gentlemen, where much besides bravery, alas, is taught, nay, where the spirit which familiarizes one with notions of battle and death, I fear, may familiarize one with ideas too, of murder. Ray, a dashing reckless fellow, from the army, had lately entered Pétel's service, was treated by him with the most singular kindness, accompanied him, having charge of another vehicle, upon the journey before alluded to, and knew that his master carried with him a considerable sum of money, for a man like Ray an enormous sum, 7,500 francs. At midnight on the 1st of November, as Madame Pétel and her husband were returning home, an attack was made upon their carriage. Remember, gentlemen, the hour at which the attack was made. Remember the sum of money that was in the carriage. And remember that the Savoy frontier is within a league of the spot where the desperate deed was done. Now, my dear Briefless, ought not Monsieur Procureur, in common justice to Pétel, after he had so eloquently proclaimed, not the facts, but the suspicions, which weighed against that worthy, to have given a similar florid account of the prisoner's case? Instead of this, you will remark that it is the advocate's endeavor to make Pétel's statements as uninteresting in style as possible, and then he demolishes them in the following way. Scarcely was Pétel's statement known, when the common sense of the public rose against it. Pétel had commenced his story upon the bridge of Andert, over the cold body of his wife. On the 2nd November he had developed it in detail, in the presence of the physicians, in the presence of the assembled neighbors of the persons who, on the day previous only, were his friends. Finally, he had completed it in his interrogatories, his conversations, his writings, and letters to the magistrates, and everywhere these words, repeated so often, were only received with a painful incredulity. The fact was that, besides the singular character which Pétel's appearance, attitude, and talk had worn ever since the event, there was in his narrative an inexplicable enigma. Its contradictions and impossibilities were such that calm persons were revolted at it, and that even friendship itself refused to believe it. Thus Mr. Attorney speaks, not for himself alone, but for the whole French public, whose opinions, of course, he knows. Pétel's statement is discredited everywhere, the statement which he had made over the cold body of his wife the monster. It is not enough simply to prove that the man committed the murder, but to make the jury violently angry against him, and cause them to shudder in the jury box, as he exposes the horrid details of the crime. Justice, goes on Mr. Substitute, who answers for the feelings of everybody, disturbed by the preoccupations of public opinion, commenced, without delay, the most active researches. The bodies of the victims were submitted to the investigations of men of art. The wounds and projectiles were examined. The place where the event took place explored with care. The morality of the author of this frightful scene became the object of rigorous examination. The exigences of the prisoner, the forms affected by him, his calculating silence, and his answers, coldly insulting, were feeble obstacles. And justice at length arrived, by its prudence, and by the discoveries it made, to the most cruel point of certainty. You see that a man's demeanor is here made a crime against him, and that Mr. Substitute wishes to consider him guilty, because he has actually the audacity to hold his tongue. Now follows a touching description of the domestic, Louis Ray. Louis Ray, a child of the hospital at Lyons, was confided, at a very early age, to some honest country people, with whom he stayed until he entered the army. At their house, and during this long period of time, his conduct, his intelligence, and the sweetness of his manners were such, that the family of his guardians became to him as an adopted family, and his departure caused them the most sincere affliction. When Louis quitted the army, he returned to his benefactors, and was received as a son. They found him just as they had ever known him. I acknowledge that this pathos beats my humble defense of Pétel entirely, except that he had learned to read and write, and the certificates of his commanders proved him to be a good and gallant soldier. The necessity of creating some resources for himself obliged him to quit his friends, and to enter the service of Monsieur de Montrichard, a lieutenant of gendarmerie, from whom he received fresh testimonials of regard. Louis, it is true, might have a fondness for wine and a passion for women, but he had been a soldier, and these faults were, according to the witnesses, amply compensated for by his activity, his intelligence, and the agreeable manner in which he performed his service. In the month of July, 1839, Ray quitted, voluntarily, the service of M. de Montrichard, and Pétel, about this period, meeting him at Lyons, did not hesitate to attach him to his service. Whatever may be the prisoner's present language, it is certain that up to the day of Louis' death, he served Pétel with diligence and fidelity. More than once his master and mistress spoke well of him. Everybody who has worked, or been at the house of Madame Pétel, has spoken in praise of his character, and, indeed, it may be said, that these testimonials were general. On the very night of the 1st of November, and immediately after the catastrophe, we remark how Pétel begins to make insinuations against his servant, and how artfully, in order to render them more sure, he disseminates them through the different parts of his narrative. But, in the course of the proceeding, these charges have met with a most complete denial. Thus we find the disobedient servant who, at Pontain, refused to carry the money chest to his master's room, under the pretext that the gates of the inn were closed securely, occupied with tending the horses after their long journey. Meanwhile Pétel was standing by, and neither master nor servant exchanged a word, and the witnesses who beheld them both have borne testimony to the zeal and care of the domestic. In like manner, we find that the servant, who was so remiss in the morning, as to neglect to go to his master for orders, was ready for departure before 7 o'clock, and had eagerly informed himself whether Monsieur and Madame Pétel were awake. Learning from the maid of the inn that they had ordered nothing for their breakfast. This man, who refused to carry with him a covering for the car, was, on the contrary, ready to take off his own cloak, and with it shelter articles of small value. This man, who had been for many days so silent and gloomy, gave, on the contrary, many proofs of his gaiety, almost of his indiscretion, speaking, at all the inns, in terms of praise of his master and mistress. The waiter at the inn at Dauphin says he was a tall young fellow, mild and good-natured. We talked for some time about horses, and such things. He seemed to be perfectly natural, and not preoccupied at all. At Pontain, he talked of his being a foundling, of the place where he had been brought up, and where he had served. And finally, at Rossillon, an hour before his death, he conversed familiarly with the master of the port, and spoke on indifferent subjects. All Pétel's insinuations against his servant had no other end than to show, in every point of Ray's conduct, the behavior of a man who was premeditating attack. Of what, in fact, does he accuse him? Of wishing to rob him of 7,500 francs, and of having had recourse to assassination, in order to effect the robbery. But, for a premeditated crime, consider what singular improvidence the person showed who had determined on committing it, what folly and what weakness there is in the execution of it. How many insurmountable obstacles are there in the way of committing and profiting by crime? On leaving Belly, Louis Ray, according to Petal's statement, knowing that his master would return with money, provided himself with a holster pistol, which Madame Petal had once before perceived among his effects. In Petal's cabinet there were some balls. Four of these were found in Ray's trunk, on the 6th of November. And, in order to commit the crime, this domestic had brought away with him a pistol, and no ammunition. For Petal has informed us that Ray, an hour before his departure from Macon, purchased 6 balls at a gunsmith's. To gain his point, the assassin must stimulate his victims. For this, he has only one pistol, knowing, perfectly well, that Petal, in all his travels, had 2 on his person. Knowing that, at a late hour of the night, his shot might fail of effect, and that, in this case, he would be left to the mercy of his opponent. The execution of the crime is, according to Petal's account, still more singular. Louis does not get off the carriage until Petal tells him to descend. He does not think of taking his master's life until he is sure that the latter has his eyes open. It is dark, and the pair are covered in one cloak, and Ray only fires at them at 6 paces distance. He fires at hazard, without disquieting himself, as to the choice of his victim, and the soldier, who was bold enough to undertake this double murder, has not force nor courage to consummate it. He flies, carrying in his hand a useless whip, with a heavy mantle on his shoulders, in spite of the detonation of 2 pistols at his ears, and the rapid steps of an angry master in pursuit, which ought to have set him upon some better means of escape. And we find this man, full of youth and vigor, lying with his face to the ground, in the midst of a public road, falling without a struggle, or resistance, under the blows of a hammer. And suppose the murderer had succeeded in his criminal projects, what fruit could he have drawn from them? Leaving, on the road, the 2 bleeding bodies, obliged to lead 2 carriages at a time, for fear of discovery, not able to return himself, after all the pains he had taken to speak, at every place at which they had stopped, of the money which his master was carrying with him, too prudent to appear alone at Belly, arrested at the frontier, by the excise officers, who would present an impassable barrier to him till morning, what could he do, or hope to do? The examination of the car has shown that Ray, at the moment of the crime, had neither linen, nor clothes, nor effects of any kind. There was found in his pockets, when the body was examined, no passport, nor certificate. One of his pockets contained a ball, of large caliber, which he had shown, in play, to a girl, at the inn at Macon, a little horn-handled knife, a snuff box, a little packet of gunpowder, and a purse, containing only a halfpenny and some string. Here is all the baggage, with which, after the execution of his homicidal plan, Louis Ray intended to take refuge in a foreign country. *. Beside these absurd contradictions, there is another remarkable fact, which must not be passed over. It is this. The pistol found by Ray is of antique form, and the original owner of it has been found. He is a curiosity merchant at Lyons, and, though he cannot affirm that Petal was the person who bought this pistol of him, he perfectly recognizes Petal as having been a frequent customer at his shop. *. This sentence is taken from another part of the deed accusation. No, we may fearlessly affirm that Louis Ray was not guilty of the crime which Petal lays to his charge. If, to those who knew him, his mild and open disposition, his military career, modest and without a stain, the touching regrets of his employers, are sufficient proofs of his innocence, the calm and candid observer, who considers how the crime was conceived, was executed, and what consequences would have resulted from it, will likewise acquit him. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.